Coming up today, the UK's dirty air, BlackBerry's demise, the end of one of the most ambitious space missions, and the start of another. You're listening to episode 287 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess, and joining me today is Victoria Wollaston.
Hello.
And Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
Jumping straight in, Vicky, what's something that you've learnt this week?
I'm a huge Drake fan. I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but this week, Drake's Views album became the first album to be streamed a billion times on Apple Music. And for all the haters out there, last year he was the most streamed artist on Spotify, so he's doing something right.
Is that his best album?
Oh, that's a difficult question.
That's a really hard question. I think maybe it's my favourite. I think it's got some good standout tracks.
I don't think I could pick one. I genuinely don't think I could pick one. I'm not such a huge fan of his mixtapes, but I couldn't pick an album. I just can't.
Amelia, what have you learnt?
I've learnt that if you are around attractive people, then this makes you look more attractive too. Some psychologists at the University of London asked people to rate different faces on their attractiveness level and were also asked to then rate the same face amongst others. And if you are around attractive people, you are attractive too.
Amelia, you're so attractive right now.
Thank you very much.
It's good news for all of us in here. And I've learnt this week that if you've got a really needy pet, and in particular a dog that is really needy, it could actually be because of its genes. So there's a research study from a number of researchers that came out and said that five different genes inside dogs make them actually want to crave human attention. And it's only in some types of dogs, but it could just be an explainer of why dogs want to be with humans all the time.
And maybe there are some humans with these genes.
Yeah, there could actually be. So to start us off this week, Vicky, this is something that's pretty close to your heart, and I think it's something we've talked about on the podcast before, quite worthily so, but it's the end of a really big space mission.
So at the very second we're recording this podcast, Rosetta Space Probe is hurtling to its death. Well, that's a little bit dramatic. The craft is making its final descent towards Comet 67P, which will ultimately spell the end of the 12 and a half year mission. I've loved this story from the beginning. I've been fascinated by it. So Rosetta spent 10 years travelling towards the comet and arrived in August 2014. A couple of months later, in November, its little plucky fillet lander was released from Rosetta and landed on the comet. I mean, the mission and what it's achieved is absolutely groundbreaking, because I remember there being a game when the fillet lander was released. There was just this game online that said, see if you could land the lander on the comet. And obviously it was just meant to be a bit of fun, and it was so difficult. So the very idea that someone at the European Space Agency could be sat there controlling this lander and making it land on something that's hurtling through space was absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's been one of these things that we followed a huge amount here, both because we cover it for Wired, and also just because we've been really interested in it personally as well. And it's sort of this mission that has taken so long in the making and has just been going on for a long time and has had suffered some problems going through it, like Fillet stopped, was lost and then found again in the most recent weeks. It's just been one of these things that is really impressive. So how is it finally finishing?
Well, reports are saying it's going to crash into the comet, which makes it sound a little bit dramatic. The reason that people are saying it's going to crash is because technically it's going to be out of control and it will hit the surface. So that's the definition of crash. But that suggests that it's going to go out into some massive big bang. What's actually going to happen is the European Space Agency is hoping it will land feet first and actually make a relatively soft landing. At the moment of impact, it's expected to hit the surface at about walking speed. Although at slow speed, there'll be no chance precision instruments on the craft will be able to survive.
So that's it. We're not going to hear from it ever again.
As it's on its descent at the moment, it's measuring all sorts of things. It's taking its final pictures. I think there was a stat that it's taken like 116,000 images of the comet since it's been in orbit of it. So last night, ESA sent those final command codes. I mean, I'm going to well up a little bit here, to the spacecraft. And so an engine burn then removed almost all of its orbital energy, which meant that it started to descend.
It's got a really like long hour drop, isn't it? It's like
15 hours or something to drop for 12 miles.
Which seems so long for such a small like distance almost.
So some of the measurements it's going to take when it's falling, it'll be analysing the gas and the dust closer to the surface of the comet. This is more accurate than it's ever been possible before. It'll take the high-res images, so it'll add to its massive gallery. And then it's expected to make its controlled impact in one of the open pits of the, I think it's pronounced Mart region. And then data from the probe should be returned during the descent up until this final moment. So up until its very last seconds, it's going to be so useful and so interesting.
Working really hard.
And yeah, that is one of the things about this, that all throughout this mission, it's taught us a lot more about comets than we've ever known before. This is the closest we've been. It's the first time we've ever put a probe, and now soon to be two probes, on a comet. And it's just taught us so much about how it's formed, how our galaxy could be formed, and our universe could be formed as well. And we've just got so much more of insight from this. But one of the things for me is, why are we sending this down, this really plucky, amazing spacecraft? Why are we sending it to its death?
Well, but I think the same thing, because so many missions just end up going past their life. So only because it served its mission. I mean, Philae is gone. Philae sent its final messages ages ago. And so, but the thing is, by ending the mission like this, actually prevents Rosetta becoming a piece of floating space debris, because there's a huge problem about obviously space junk floating around and causing damage to satellites and stuff. Mm. But it's like what you said, it will also allow us to have this really close-up look at a comet like that we wouldn't have seen before.
So it would have been possible before to get these images, because of it being so close, would it not be able to come back up again? Is that the thing?
Yeah. Okay. And it just because it's captured by the orbit of the... it's all in sync, so yeah. Obviously if it drops out, it's very difficult because of the gravity of the comet, it's very difficult to then get back up there again. And I think the reason why it's captured so many people's imagination, it's not just because it's a bit interesting, but it just shows what's capable.
Yeah.
That's what I loved about it so much, is that, like I said earlier on, someone is sat in a room controlling this Rosetta probe like miles and miles and miles away in uncharted territory for humans. It blows my mind that someone could do something like that. And I think that's what people, it's not just let's celebrate how good the mission what has been, but actually looking forward, it gives us hope that there's other things that we could do.
Yeah, and I think there are future plans for NASA to go and actually capture an asteroid and sort of bring it towards Earth a little bit and study asteroids a lot closer. So it's one of these spaces that we are going to be looking a lot more into details about this asteroid and also other asteroids. And researchers going to be looking at this data for a long time as well. So in the last few months, they've only just been publishing studies around some of the data that was collected from the comet about 2 years ago. So it's really, this is going to be something that keeps on going and gives us a lot more, even though the mission has actually ended. And if you want to actually look at some of the last pictures that came back from Rosetta as it approached its final crash landing, if we want to call it a crash, then you can see them up on wired.co.uk. So our second story this week is all about air pollution in the UK. We actually learnt that 90% of the UK's population lives in areas where pollution levels are dangerously high. So people outdoors are breathing in really dangerous levels, high levels of polluted air at all times. And when you consider there's 64 million people in the UK, this 90% figure equals about 57 million people living with really bad air conditions. And we all live in London here. So does this surprise you, or are you really seeing this quite a lot?
In London, you can definitely feel that the air is different, and particularly like just going on the tube and breathing in all those fumes regularly. But for it to be 90%, I think that's more shocking, because I don't know, you think of the rest of the country as green fields.
Well, it's like you go for a walk in the fresh air when you go to the countryside, and ironically, it's actually not that much fresher, is it?
No, it's not. And that's actually what this study has shown. But to try and get to that point where we can show that why this is a lot more, why the rural areas in the country are a lot more covered as well, I think it helps to really try and explain what air pollution is in this case. So there are basically two different types of air pollution. One that involves really small, tiny particles that are absolutely minute, and these are all around in the air, and also ones at larger particles. So this study, which was looking at outdoor air and was conducted by the University of Bath and the World Health Organization, I was actually looking at these really small particles, and a model created during the research focused on the ultrafine particles, which have a diameter of less than 2.5 micrometers. So these are really tiny. We can only see them when they're in basically massive clumps, and there's a lot of them about at one time, and they are called PM 2.5 particles, and they're basically fine particles that reduce visibility and cause the air to look hazy. So if you get the tube in London, for example, you will sometimes go down onto the platform and see just like loads of like hazy, misty sort of air looking down the tunnel, and that's these sort of particles. So you can only see them when they're in a really big group. And these can be created by both humans and also sort of man-made processes as well. However, most of them are created by us and our activities on the planet.
So, I mean, like, how dangerous is this?
They are actually really quite dangerous, the World Health Organization is saying. So the small particles can get into our lungs and basically clog them up and stop us breathing and have lots of problems. And the data in the study, which is from 2012, because that's basically the last really big reliable data set that could actually be looked at in the UK, and the study also looked at around the world. So that was the last sort of point where there was comparable data. But there were 16,335 deaths in the UK in 2012 because of air pollution.
Deaths?
Yeah, actual deaths.
Not just
deaths.
Illnesses, actual deaths.
Yeah, so these are basically derived from the data. There were around 7,000 people with a type of heart disease, 5,000 people with lung disease, 3,700 suffered from strokes, from not being able to breathe properly, and there were just a lot of other deaths from other related illnesses. And that doesn't even take into account the people that have breathing problems or other cases or other diseases that come from this and didn't die.
Such as like asthma and things like that.
Yeah, so they're all exacerbated by this air pollution that is around us at all times.
So, I mean, what's it actually like in the UK? I know you said like 90%, but like spread-wise, I would just imagine it's all in the city. So what's it like?
So obviously 90% is most of the population. So that's where people are living. The big cities, London, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, are some of the highest levels with the biggest air pollution, which isn't surprising, as we've all said, and sort of the authors from this study actually said that to us as well. But Gavin Chadwick from the University of Bath, who was involved in this, told us that he was actually surprised that some of the other smaller cities and less urban areas have actually got these levels of pollution as well. And he said that you'd actually have to go to a pretty rural place to be out of it. So we're talking like Upper Scotland, like South Wales, and a few places, not in the cities in South Wales, but around some of the like really rural areas. And basically, he was saying that he was surprised, and he's somebody who looks at this data quite often, just how much of the country is covered in air pollution.
Is that because we're an island, so we're pretty packed in?
No, it's not really, because the whole study was looking at the rest of the world as well, and we actually compare, I guess rather depressingly, on a very similar level to the rest of the world and the air levels of air pollution around there. So this study actually looked at almost every single country. There was 3,000 different cities involved in this, and like 6,000 monitoring stations around the world, and I think there was 103 countries, so most of the large countries and quite a few of the smaller ones as well. But 92% of the people on the whole planet, so that's 9 out of 10, live in places where air pollution is higher than the acceptable limits.
And where is it worst?
So the worst places are, as you would imagine from seeing pictures of it being really smoggy, China, India, a few of those places. And basically the researchers created all this data, brought it all in together to expose like how big a deal this actually is, and that there needs to be sort of some action taken on it. And they really looked at basically data collected on the ground from satellites, and just really exposed how worrying this whole situation is.
Did they say what the study is going to go on do? Is it just to raise awareness of how bad it is, or?
So I think yes, the study itself was actually looking mostly at what the problem is, but yeah, the World Health Organization has got its own schemes and its own campaigns looking to actually try and reduce air levels by, I think, 2030 is the year that they're looking to try and bring some of the pollution down, which is not that far away, but there's going to be a lot of work to be done, and there's quite a few regulations in countries and schemes going around. I know the UK has got one scheme at least that's trying to remove certain particles from being put out into the air. Countries are looking at different ways of producing energy that isn't coal burning. So it is something that is people are working towards, but as the populations around the world increases, this is still going to be a massive problem for people.
It just seems crazy that it's 90% of the world's population. That's such a huge scale.
So as part of this study, the World Health Organization actually released some maps, and it's all good and well us saying these figures, but seeing those maps and seeing the spread of the red that shows where this air pollution is, it's everywhere. Mm. And it makes me think that sometimes you see people walking around London with the face masks on that become really popular in China because of all the smog, and occasionally I think, oh, that's quite dramatic, but I didn't realize the high level of deaths that are involved in that.
Yeah, it's I actually have one of those masks from when I went to stay in China, because it was so cold. We wore them then to keep your nose from freezing, and I might actually bring it down to London with me.
Yeah, it is something that I think we all need to be aware of and just be a little bit more conscious of at times, and a lot wider spread than even people in the know thought it was. Yeah. So, Amelia, you have been looking at blackberry, not the fruit this week, to make a terrible, terrible joke, I'm sorry, but the phone maker.
So this is a bit of a sad story as well. BlackBerry have announced that they're shutting down its hardware division. So it's not going to make any handsets in-house anymore. It's going to start outsourcing them, because it's kind of realized it can't really compete with the likes of Apple and Samsung anymore. And I mean, they did announce earlier this year that they were going to call time on its classic handset, which was like a standard BlackBerry full QWERTY keyboard. I think it did have a touchscreen though. But really, we can say goodbye to the full QWERTY keypad now.
See, I used to have a BlackBerry Bold, I think it was a 9990.
Yeah, I think I had that one as well.
And that was my first proper smartphone. Mm. And I absolutely loved the keyboard. And I remember people saying to me, oh, you should get this, you should get the iPhone, you should get this. And I was really reluctant to give up those keys because I was like, I don't think I could use touchscreen. I've got hoof hands. My thumbs are too fat. But actually, looking back now, it's such a shame that we've gone this way. But it was completely, I'm not surprised by this at all.
I think it was definitely the touchscreen thing. I didn't get rid of my BlackBerry until about 2012, 2013, which isn't that long ago, really. But I remember just being, you know, particularly because the App Store was so big and all the great games were coming out, you just couldn't play on a BlackBerry. You were like, oh, I'm over this now. But I actually do still see people using BlackBerries, really on the tube, I think. I think it's more of a work phone now than a casual phone. So
I think Kim Kardashian famously has an iPhone and a BlackBerry.
Hers broke earlier this year, and everyone was posting on Twitter about it saying, oh, I didn't realize anyone used a BlackBerry anymore. It must just have been Kim Kardashian. I think it was funny.
I think that's key though, what you said about apps, is that the reason I wanted to get rid of a BlackBerry is because of the software.
Yeah.
The phone itself was fine to a point. But that's the reason why I have an iPhone. I'm not massively sold on Apple. I'm not a huge fangirl about it. But the software, I prefer to Android. And when you want to be playing these apps and doing these things, and the reason you want to use a smartphone, if the phone doesn't do that, then that's sort of redundant.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I do find with Apple over Samsung as well. Like apps like Instagram, quite often a lot of apps are more catered towards to an iOS phone. And that was the thing with BlackBerry's. BlackBerry's didn't have Instagram, and that was when Instagram was really taking off and becoming really big. And yeah, and it just seems that the kind of software didn't almost catch up as much in a way as Apple and Samsung then went and changed the game a bit too much for them, I think.
But this isn't the end of BlackBerry though, is it?
It's not actually. So basically, the company is just scrapping its hardware division and is going to focus on software and security applications and things like that. So they're not going to be making any more BlackBerry phones in-house, but they will be making BlackBerry branded handsets, but just a different company will make them. So similar to the way Google manufactured all its Nexus devices. But this may change when it's supposed to announce its own brand Pixel phones, which is supposed to be soon.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because BlackBerry's going one way and Google's going the other.
Yeah, but BlackBerry did say, I think last year, that if they didn't sell 5 million handsets a year, it was going to give up. In the first quarter of 2015, it sold only 1.1 million. But in 4 years earlier, in 2011, it sold 13.2 million in that same space of time. So it definitely just shows how the tide has turned away from BlackBerry, and I guess it is the right decision that they're making. They're still going to they bought their first Android phone out last year, which has a touchscreen and then slides down to have a full QWERTY keyboard. But I think, so obviously they are going to keep up with doing the Android phones. It's just they won't be doing the classic BlackBerry Bold anymore. So sad.
I think the problem with that though is that then they're suddenly competing. When they were BlackBerry and they had the QWERTY keyboard and they had the BlackBerry OS and it was at its height and they're really secure. And I mean, part of this is they're saying, we're actually going to take away from the hardware division and concentrate on our software. That's what we're good at in terms of security and enterprise. But by doing it this way, although they're appealing to the wider audience, they're then coming into a really saturated market. Mm-hmm. So it then all becomes about handset. It all becomes about specs and power and camera. And it depends on who's going to be making these phones, whether that's even going to be possible.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the big things to see, like, what actually comes out of this and where their handset design goes and basically how the manufacturing quality is as well. One of my old BlackBerries was really robust. It used to be fantastic until I sat on it in the back pocket of my jeans and broke it. But it was actually just a phone that you knew what you were doing with it. You were sending your emails, you were answering your phone calls like a phone, but just in a business capacity most of the time. And to be honest, I would still sort of use one nowadays if I could get one that was just like completely just for use for work, no fun or anything like that, and then just get through everything on there and then not have to worry about it, take it out and have my emails turned on at all times.
Yeah.
Then I could still consider a BlackBerry, but we'll see how the company goes and how all their new handsets and what their software does come out to be. But they've obviously got a really big task in competing with Apple and Samsung and other Android device makers as well.
Yeah, and now obviously, particularly if Google are coming back and bringing out a new phone, that's going to be really exciting. And all these big like competitors are going to go up against. But it was funny what you said about a BlackBerry like being really durable, though, because how many people do you know that ever had to get a BlackBerry screen fixed? So clearly they were onto something there.
Or charge their phone every night.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Elon Musk. We know him from SpaceX, Tesla, SolarCity. This week he's been doing one of his most ambitious plans that is related to SpaceX, but he's been saying how he wants to put humans on Mars. There's no secret that he's actually been wanting to put humans on Mars for a while. He's talked about creating colonies on the planet since 2012, but at the 67th International Astronautical Congress in, I think it was Mexico, this week, Musk said that he wants to build a population of up to 1 million people on Mars to begin with. And he basically set out his vision for this big grand plan of making humans a different interplanetary species. So not just living on Earth anymore, living on different colonies away from Earth. And he wants to do this because he says that life on Earth is going to go extinct at some point. The planet is going to die out. And I think with climate change, things like this, that's not particularly that arguable, and there is scientific reason behind it. So he said that the alternative is becoming a spacefaring civilization and a multi-planetary species. To colonize the planet, it would take 40 to 100 years, he said, and he imagines there'll be up to 1,000 large people-carrying transport ships in space. These are ferrying people around, carrying goods, bringing people to and from Earth, maybe even other planets in the future. He said that his spacecraft could go to other moons, other planets that could sustain life. And SpaceX is planning on beginning doing this in March 2018 when they launch their first mission to Mars. And the first unmanned probe will actually be sent around that time. And then every 18 months, they're going to keep sending probes. And the first manned mission, Musk said that he wants to launch as soon as 2022 and put humans on Mars. So at the heart of his plan here is actually getting us to Mars, and for this he needs really, 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 really powerful rockets.
Well, that's what's so interesting about this, is it's not just some guy saying I want us to go to Mars. He's backing it up. He's doing all the science, he's doing all the stuff behind it. So SpaceX has successfully launched, I think it's 6 rockets into orbit and re-landed them on Earth. I mean, it recently attempted a 7th and it didn't go particularly well when it blew up on the test pad. But the Falcon 9 rockets, they've carried payloads into orbit before they're sent to the ISS or left circling the planet. And then they've been guided to landing points at sea and on land by GPS. I mean, it goes back to the whole landing of the lander on the comet. Obviously, this is probably a little bit easier, but it's not easy. So the rockets that are being tested currently won't be the ones that are used to get to Mars, though. He actually thinks they're going to have to be much heavier, much more powerful developments needed. And in September, Musk said his firm's heavy-duty spacecraft would be responsible for getting humans to the red planet. So the rocket is called the Interplanetary Transport System.
Pretty cool name.
ITS. Musk says it'll be able to carry about 100 tons of cargo or 100 people to Mars. It also has, like you said, Matt, he's saying it has a potential to go well beyond Mars, although according to his calculations, but I don't think he actually gave us any more information. So this huge advanced carbon fiber ITS spaceship and booster, it would have the thrust power of 13,000 tons, propelled by 42 engines using cryogenic methane as rocket fuel. Musk sees 1,000 of these enormous ships sitting in orbit, and he actually, during the press conference, he described it as Battlestar Galactica, and then he just was like, it's a good show. So it's set to be built and developed for human missions in 2025. However, before this, SpaceX will, like you said, be sending these unmanned missions up there. And Musk just said you can count on it. It's going to happen every 26 months, like a train leaving the station.
2025 is not that far away. It's crazy to envision it and to imagine it.
Well, when on one hand he's saying, oh, 40 to 100 years, so you almost think, oh, it's a bit of a pipe dream, it's not going to be within some of our lifetime.
Yeah.
But then when he's saying, no, 2018, we're going to do this, 2022, we're going to do this, 2025, this is within our lifetime. This is serious.
Like, happening, not now, but almost. It's, yeah, he's got big visions, Elon Musk. But it's good because he has big plans, and if he wants to carry them out, that's what he needs.
And what does he want to do when we actually get people there in around 2025 and slightly beyond that, as we go a little bit further down the line, I guess?
So his colonization plans, as he's calling it, he wants to build a 1 million strong population on Mars because that will be fully populated. Well, that's what he thinks it is. If the crew numbers for each ship stays at 100, he thinks he's going to need to do at least 10,000 trips to Mars in order to populate it. So this initial group of humans, he thinks, well, maybe in 2025, he thinks around 10 people can go to Mars, take construction materials, and they can build pressurized domes where food can be grown.
That sounds very much like
The Martian.
The Martian.
Damon.
I think maybe that's where Musk got some inspiration from. But he thinks, like, ultimately 80,000 people could live in a colony. And it's just, like, the word colony is so funny. It's, like, such, like, a... like an idea of, like, from like a space film, you know, of like different colonies living on different planets. It's crazy. But obviously at first he thinks it's going to need to be like really wealthy individuals that are going on the first planes because it's going to be so expensive. He said that he wants to bring it down by about 500%, but like, and tickets could eventually cost about $500,000, so about £385,000. So in 2025, you could buy a house, maybe. Actually, it might be a bit more expensive then, or you could go to Mars. So that's a decision that some of you may be making. Someone's going to be making that decision, aren't they?
And would either of you two want to go to Mars at any point or live on Mars? Maybe not as the first people that are going to go there and may die on the planet, because if things don't go to plan, it could not go well. But if we do create a colony, would you see yourself in 40 to 60 years time being one of these people that would live not on Earth?
100% no.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it until today, really. And I can't really get my head around it, but... oh, I just don't know. Kind of freaks me out a bit.
It would just be so different. You would have to, you would obviously be growing your food as we do grow food down here, but it would just have in different environments. Everything that you do would have to be considering about going outside, if that's a dangerous thing. Have you got your thing on? Is the airlock done properly? And it's just like, it just adds so much more thought into the whole process of being alive for me.
Yeah, the air is a massive point to make. Like, what is, you're just going to have to be in a spacesuit the whole time? I think it's really great that he has this idea and he really wants to do it. And he's obviously putting the plans in there, but we've never ever had humans on Mars. How do we know that we can live there?
And it's the landscape more than anything else for me. I know it sounds really cheesy, but I like green fields and I like sort of the sea and things like that. And I think going up there, it'd just be this dusty, barren landscape. So then all you'd end up doing is sort of being stuck indoors with the people. And if you don't like them, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And there are a few things around this plan that have been criticised and have been not necessarily, not rubbish, but people are saying, do we need some more thought into this? And this is one of the first times that Musk has actually really came out and said what his sort of bigger plan was. He's given small clues in the past, but this is sort of the biggest sort of vision that he's put out there first. And Robert Zubrin, who is an aerospace engineer and actually an author on this topic and is really enthusiastic about us going to Mars, said that he doesn't think there are any practical things that are really wrong with this. Like, he says it can actually be achieved. He reckons that Musk is on the right idea and that fuels rockets, when they're sent to Mars, could actually create and be refueled by methane and oxygen combination being created on the planet, so you could send them back. But he did say that the propulsion systems could be done differently. He said that the whole system shouldn't be sent to Mars. Some of it should fall back down to Earth more early in the stage of its flight and progression, so it could be used again in a faster way, and which would ultimately make things a bit cheaper, he said.
Well, that's the big question. Like, what about the funding? Who's going to fund this?
Yeah, that is one of the really difficult things about this. Obviously, when Musk is sending loads of people up at a time, sending 100 people on a ship and £300,000 each, that's a good chunk of money that's coming in and a business plan for the future. But as SpaceX develops these technologies, they are going to have to put a lot of their own money, a lot of Musk money into this. And he's a very, very wealthy man, but he obviously has a finite amount of resources altogether. And I assume he hopes some of his other companies and other funders will get on board with this. But to develop like 5 or 6 different rockets that are just sending people to Mars in different sizes, and the fuel and everything around them, is just costing such a huge amount of money. It's like, is he going to have enough? Is other people going to be involved in this? And how much is this going to cost? That's an insane amount, really.
It could even end up becoming like almost like a bit of a, if our planet is going to be not going to be livable in the next 100 years, is it going to become like a class thing? Like, if you have enough money, you can go. If you don't, you have to stay and rot. Like, there are a lot of implications for the wider humanity that, you know, obviously aren't being addressed, like haven't been addressed yet.
Yeah, and it's obviously Musk isn't the only person that is actually looking at this, and we've talked about him a lot on the podcast, and a lot of people talk about him in a very evangelical way, and he is doing a lot of good out there, but he's not the only one trying to get to Mars, is he, Vicky?
No, NASA. Good old NASA. I mean, NASA robots have been on or orbiting Mars for like 40 years, but the agency also wants to send humans to the planet, and the agency's actually aiming for a landing date of 2030s. So in fairness, it's not that much after Musk and his billions.
Yeah.
So the first major milestone on NASA's mission is going to be November 2018. NASA plans to send its Space Launch System rocket into orbit from Space Center in Florida. The mission is called Exploration Mission 1, and it will carry the Orion spacecraft without astronauts thousands of miles beyond the moon during an it'll take about a 3-week mission. Then they'll send astronauts, will climb into Orion for a similar mission. They will travel like much farther than humans have ever traveled before. And then also in the 2020s, NASA plans to send astronauts on a year-long mission into deep space just to prove, they call it proving ground. It's basically just trying to verify whether it's even possible and to test our readiness for Mars. Because if we've never traveled that far before, it's not just about the technology getting to us there, it's can our bodies actually cope with it? And then there's another company so Mars One. There was loads and loads of publicity about Mars One, I think, last year, and it sort of died down a little bit. So Mars One, it's not an aerospace firm. It's not in the same way that NASA or Musk is trying to put this money into rockets and developing this technology. It's a much more conceptual idea. And what Mars One is doing is concentrating on the settlement itself. What will that look like? How will it be populated? What will we need to do in order to make that a success? I mean, I say it's conceptual, and they've done these concept designs. They've also been quite serious. They've been recruiting for people to sign up to do this. And it reminds me a little bit of Big Brother in the way that they get these people who have various walks of life, but some of them seem so fame hungry. And some of them, when they're doing the interviews afterwards, they're like, oh, why do you want to go to Mars? And like a few people were like, well, why not? And I get that question. And I admire that sort of spirit. But it does make you wonder questions like, do you actually know you're going to go to Mars? Because if you haven't really considered, if the only reason you're going to Mars is because why not? I don't think you've really considered what it's going to be like.
Yeah, and I think Mars One has actually had quite a bit of criticism in the last year or so about its selection process, if it can actually achieve these things as well. And some of the same questions have actually been raised about funding, whether they have got the technology and the experience and things to do that, that are being raised with Musk and NASA and other people as well. But I think the idea is there. Many people are looking at this. They're developing ways that we can try and get to Mars. So it is a legitimate plan. And with an agency like NASA that's doing its own work in the area and trying to send humans there, that really does give it the sort of like stamp and seal of approval, I guess. And just to touch on NASA a little bit more, in the next issue of Wired magazine, which is coming out next week, we have actually got quite a big NASA reveal that's very exclusive to Wired. And without giving too much away, Vicky, can you just tell us a tiny little bit about what you could expect in this issue?
So a photographer called Benedict Redgrove went over to NASA, got absolutely unprecedented access to its systems and to some of its rockets, to some of its robonauts that it's working on. And he sent back some absolutely fascinating images that we will be putting online. So you can obviously buy the magazine next week, and you out on Thursday, but subscribers will get it earlier. But over the next, we're going to have a NASA month. October is going to be our NASA month, and if you keep coming back to the site, you'll get new pictures, new features, just trying to celebrate how good this agency is.
It's very exciting. I think the images are my favorite thing about space, just seeing you know, the amazing things that NASA are going to be doing, and then also just even just looking at the Rosetta images, like, it really helps bring it to life.
Well, that's the thing. I've been a bit negative about a couple of things in terms of the Mars mission, but the fact that someone actually wants to do this and the fact they're thinking beyond Earth actually should be credited, because it's beyond me and my thought process to do that. But I guess if the Earth is heading that way, we need to start thinking of these sorts of options.
Yeah, and there we are. That's it for the podcast this week. Would you go to Mars? Please tell us. Tweet us in. Tweet us at Wired UK, or you can get Vicky at...
Vicky Wollaston.
Amelia.
At AmeliaX1.
And I'm at MattBurgess1. Thank you very much for listening. Go out and buy the magazine next week. There's some fantastic stuff in there, and we'll hope to speak to you all soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.